You know, while I was reading a lot of post-apocalyptic stuff, the trap is that something terrible has happened and the people in it have to survive. And that can be a very one-dimensional story. You know, it's just something bad happened. You know, will they survive or not? And the thing about The Road is it goes so deep into humanity and relationship and love. And the very end is the promise of love. You know, it's the promise of the species continuing, you know, and the promise that humanity can and will survive.
From Bookworms in the Wild and from Spotify, I'm Howard Alterescu, and this is my podcast where I ask people I find interesting to tell me what they're reading. Before I introduce my guest today, I'll mention a few books I've read since my last podcast. Ben recently read and gave me Disgrace by J.M. Coetzee, a two-time Booker Prize winner, including for this one. The book takes place in Cape Town, South Africa. It's an early Me Too moment for a professor's college student, complex, uncomfortable, and elegantly written. After reviewing the novel when it was published in 1999, The New Yorker reviewed it again at the time of the Harvey Weinstein trial in 2020. Both stories of abuse, each with its own elements of depravity. Disgrace indeed. On a much lighter note, one of my favorite authors is Ann Patchett, the author of The Dutch House, which I read some time ago. Patchett has been obsessed since high school with Thornton Wilder's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Our Town, and has had a longtime desire to write about Our Town. Patchett's new novel, Tom Lake, fulfills that desire. When I started Tom Lake, I immediately realized that I needed to first read Our Town. So I did, and I'm glad I did. As I said on my last podcast, Our Town is all about the preciousness of life and community. It's timeless, important, moving, and a classic. The same can be said about Tom Lake, a really beautiful read. And then, back to the dark side. On an Upper Birdcliff Road walk this past summer, I noted to my friends Perry Beekman and David Gordon the recent death of Robert Gottlieb, the most acclaimed book editor of the last 50 plus years. I've previously mentioned on the podcast Gottlieb's really great memoir, Avid Reader. David noted that writer Cormac McCarthy had also then recently died. David expressed enthusiasm for McCarthy's great works over the years. I had read McCarthy's Pulitzer Prize winning masterpiece, The Road, many years prior, and I still get a chill in my bones when I think about it. I asked David whether he would like to come on the podcast to commemorate Cormac McCarthy and to talk about The Road and the rest of McCarthy's great works. And here we are. David was trained at Parsons and the New York Academy of Art and has art directed and or worked on visual development, layout, and character design for numerous production companies, from Lucasfilm to Pixar. He has also written and illustrated many children's books and acclaimed graphic novels. And David was kind enough a few years ago to give me signed copies of some of his books for my grandchildren. Welcome to the podcast, David.
Thanks, Howard.
I reread The Road in preparation for our discussion. Published in 2006, The Road is a dystopian, post-apocalyptic, and frightening warning. But it's also a story of the love between a father and a son, and of the lengths to which a father might travel for his son, literally and figuratively. It's also beautifully written and moving. The chilling nature of the novel is captured by a 2013 review in The Economist. Quote, McCarthy stole apocalypse's thunder and produced something far more terrible because more tentative. He saw that apocalypse is about the aftermath, rather than grand finale. He knew that the one thing more terrifying than dying in a global catastrophe is surviving it. The disaster is over and done with in a single sentence. A long shear of light and then a series of low concussions. What follows is the desperate business of endurance. A 2006 review in The Guardian captured the emotion of the story. The Road is a novel of transforming power and formal risk. Abandoning gruff but profound male camaraderie, McCarthy instead sounds the limits of imaginable love and despair between a diligent father and his timid young son, each other's world entire. The initial experience of the novel is sobering and oppressive. Its final effect is emotionally shattering. On these sobering notes, David, please share your thoughts about Cormac McCarthy, The Road, and the other McCarthy novels that you've read. What do you think?
Well, it's one of my favorite books, if not my favorite book. You know, like all apocalyptic or post-apocalyptic novels, there's this trap of the post-apocalyptic story, which is something terrible has happened, a nuclear war, you know, the grid goes down. I've read many, many post-apocalyptic novels. It's kind of my thing.
Oh, God.
And it was my thing. And I think I abandoned that thing after the pandemic because things got so scary and I needed something a little more uplifting. But while I was in it, while I was reading a lot of post-apocalyptic stuff, the trap is that something terrible has happened and the people in it have to survive. And that can be a very one-dimensional story. You know, it's just something bad happened. You know, will they survive or not? And the thing about The Road is it goes so deep into humanity and relationship and love. And can I do a spoiler alert?
No.
We can't talk about the end.
Oh, well, you know, it was published such a long time ago. And I read it for a second time. I knew how it ended, and I loved it still. So let's spoil it. Sorry, okay. Everybody.
Well, you know, the very end is, I won't go into specifics, but the very end is the promise of love. You know, it's the promise of the species continuing, you know, and the promise that humanity can and will survive. But I have to say that I read books and I listen to them. And if there's a movie, I will watch the movie. And I read the book twice. I listened to it now a third time recently this week. And I've seen the movie twice. So, and it is so dark.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, all apocalyptic or post-apocalyptic stories are by their very nature dark, but this is poetically dark. This is as profoundly, deeply dark as I think you can get, almost to the point where it was hard to listen to it again. And I think in this post-pandemic world, I don't know if it's because I'm older or we've been through a mini apocalypse with the pandemic, nowhere close to what happens in The Road.
Right.
But, you know, the way the environment is going, and I have very young nieces and nephews, and I worry about them, and I worry about what's going to happen to the world, and, you know, how we can't predict weather anymore, and, you know, the threat of nuclear war with Putin and invading the Ukraine. I know I'm getting very dark right now.
Well, and so the Road, I think I mentioned it, The Road is a lot of things, and one of the things is it's a warning. And actually, when we first discussed talking about The Road, I didn't think of it this way, but I think more people need to read The Road because it is a warning of how terrible things can be. And not just the immediate impact on the environment and the economy and on people generally, but the way McCarthy talks about the relationship between a father and son just boils it all down.
Yeah.
This is real life. These are human beings. It has a direct impact on individuals and lives. And it's a warning.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a warning. And also, you know, the relationship, the reference to the boy's mother.
Yes.
You know, and how she kills herself with a piece of obsidian. it's sort of the difference between hope and despair.
Yes.
You know, I mean, right. she says that, you know, her heart was broken the minute he was born, because he was born, you know, after the apocalypse, like right after the apocalypse. Right. And he argues for her to carry on, and she doesn't. She kills herself. And the day after she kills herself, they hit the road. And he has hope, right? He has hope. He has humanity. And the humanity lies in their relationship. That is the essence of humanity. It's not just surviving alone. It's not just offing yourself in a, you know, when things look really bad. I mean, you could argue that she had every reason to kill herself. There was, I mean, it looked hopeless, and most of the book is very hopeless, but there was just enough hope for him and enough humanity and enough love for his son for them to hit the road,
right,
and try to survive and go south.
Right.
Yeah.
Wherever, without direction.
Yeah.
Except they just had to keep moving.
Yep.
Yeah. The mother killing herself, the despair on the one hand, and the father's hope. And interestingly, never named. They never have names, do they?
Yeah, right? Nobody has any.
And there's hardly any punctuation.
Yeah.
And there are no chapters. He's amazing, but it flows and it flies by. The thought comes to mind, there's a book called The Uninhabitable Earth. It's by David Wallace Wells, who happens to be the son-in-law of a good friend of ours, Roseanne. So I knew that when I was reading the book that he had a daughter. But he says in the book that with all the terrible consequences of our environmental failures, of global warming and the like, people ask him, will you bring a child into this world? And he says, yes, I would, and yes, I have. I have a young child. And things will not be the same for children today. Things will not be the same in the future as they are for us. And we could do better, but they will adapt. Now, adapting to imaginable environmental change seems potentially feasible. Adapting to whatever will come next down the road for this young boy, I just can't imagine.
Yeah. I know what happened. I know what the apocalypse was in that story. Do you know what it was?
Well, I think there was a nuclear bomb. Is that right?
No.
No. Oh, good. Learning time. Go right ahead.
Well,
when you say you know, describe how you know, please.
Well, there's hints of it all over.
Right.
She commits suicide with a piece of obsidian. Why would there be surface attainable obsidian in the Mid-South, right? And he talks about macadam, which is...
For the road.
And then everything's covered in ash.
Right.
And there's a little sequence where an earthquake rumbles underground, and they meet somebody on the road who's been hit by lightning. And this is all stuff of a super caldera.
And what is that?
A super caldera?
Yeah.
So a super caldera is a super volcano. And there is one in Yellowstone.
Really?
Right now. Yeah.
Yeah. You mean that event is taking place in Yellowstone?
Very slowly.
Slowly?
Yes, very slowly.
I love Yellowstone.
Yeah, yeah. Yellowstone's beautiful, but there's a lake. I think it might be Jenny Lake.
I know Jenny Lake.
Yeah, it might be Jenny Lake, or it might be something else. And the boundaries of the lake are shifting. And the boundaries of the lake are shifting because there is a dome of magma that is developing under the lake.
Underground.
Now, we think of a volcano or a caldera as a cone. Well, this one is... The opening of it is many square miles, many, many, many square miles. And they have evidence that this caldera has exploded in the past. They have a lot of evidence of it. And I know that Cormac McCarthy was researching this before the road, that he was talking to scientists and he was trying to figure out what a really good civilization ending event would be that wouldn't kill people with radiation. I think
interesting. Yeah.
You know, and the cities are burning and there's a lot of burning. These are all things that could happen in a nuclear war, of course, but
no radiation. Right. I don't think there's any evidence of radiation.
No.
Right.
No evidence of radiation. So something like that would end civilization because the particles and the soot from it would be ejected into the atmosphere above the weather, and it would cool the Earth down enough.
This is the super caldera.
Yeah. The same thing could happen in a nuclear war, but.
Well, cool things down because it blocks the sun. Is that right? Blocks the sun?
It blocks the sun, and you only have to lose a couple degrees, you know, to kill billions of people from starvation, right? You know, it's either like, you know, we're so in the Goldilocks zone. It's right now we're worried about global warming, right? But in an event like that, that's exactly the thing you'd be wishing for.
This may be my last podcast, but go ahead.
So anyway, I think it was a super caldera, and it was a perfect, I mean, in a way, if you think about it, if that was the event in the road, there was nothing anybody could have done about it. So
right.
No human behavior caused it, right? It wasn't of our own doing.
So it's unlike global warming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Unlike the opposite of global warming. Yeah.
Right. But yeah, in many ways, but also there's much evidence that human behavior contributes to global warming.
Right.
There's no evidence that human behavior has anything to do with caldera. Have you told anybody in Yellowstone about your theory?
A lot of people in Yellowstone know.
Oh, they know about it already. Okay.
Yeah. And it's a thing. And it's a, you know, in the apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic circles, people are very well aware of this. They're, you know, everybody's aware of nuclear war, you know, and there's a super caldera flavor. And then there's the grid down situation,
right?
You know, like where malevolent actors destroy our grid. It's all very dark.
Oh God, is it? and so let's go back to Yellowstone and that super caldera and related to the road. So if there is an underground eruption under Jenny Lake, beautiful lake.
Yeah.
I've fished that lake.
I could be wrong about that lake, but
they're all gorgeous. Yeah. There. And that underground volcano erupted. Is there any way of knowing how widespread the disruption would be? I guess it depends on the size of the eruption and its impact on the atmosphere.
If it blows, it would be huge, right? Yeah. So there was a time, I don't know what archaeological era this was, but there was they found a place in Nebraska where there was an ancient watering hole, and this goes back far enough where there were zebras and there were hippos and I think elephants, small elephants.
In Nebraska.
In Nebraska. So we're talking, you know, many millions of years ago, predated humanity. There's an excavation going on of an ancient watering hole where masses of these beasts died all at once. And they found evidence of... there, I don't know the name of it, but it's a pitting in their jawbones that is caused from breathing in ash. It's part of the disease of having breathed in ash. And they trace the molecular structure of the ash in this watering hole excavation to Yellowstone.
To Yellowstone?
Yes.
Interesting.
Right. Yeah. To what is now... you know, the known super caldera, which has erupted millions and millions of years ago. So it has happened before, it could happen again. And like I said, there's the lake is moving because the magma dome is expanding. And there's absolutely no way to know if this thing is going to blow tomorrow or if it's going to blow, you know, a couple million years from now. But if it does, that's it for us.
Or when it does. So going back to the hope part of our discussion, you never know what the impact will be. it's not going to be good.
You don't?
To the point that David Wallace Wells made, people will adapt somehow to the extent possible.
Yep.
And you just don't know.
You just don't know. And there have been, I think they're called genetic bottlenecks in our history. This is where there are cataclysms that reduced our, you know, the human population down to, I think, several thousand. And we survived that. And that can be traced through genetics. So we've survived before.
Yeah, and you do never know. Well, so did you learn of these possibilities after reading The Road and researching, or just in your general reading, these came to your attention?
It's just my general reading. I think part of it comes from having grown up during, you know, the height of the Cold War. And, you know, looking back, you know, there was the Cuban Missile Crisis, obviously predated me.
It did not predate me, and I remember it.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, looking back and reading about it and being interested in it, there were other moments where things came as close as the Cuban Missile Crisis to total nuclear annihilation. And there were some false alarms that NORAD had encountered in 1983. 1983 was, I think, the height of the number of nuclear weapons that each side had. I think both sides had 25,000 or so. Now we're down to about 5,000. And it was something, I grew up in Colorado. I grew up in southeastern Denver. And I knew NORAD was, you know, only like 60, 70 miles away from where I grew up. And it was in my imagination for, you know, since I was a little kid. I read a lot of Stephen King, The Stand.
There you go. Yeah. That'll do it.
Yeah. So it's just kind of woven into my early brain development. Yeah. I've always been interested in it. But like I said, I don't know if it's because I'm getting older and, you know, I have young people in my family that I worry about. I'm not as interested in it. In fact, I'm scared of it, you know. I must confess, it used to be entertainment, but now I'm losing sleep over it.
Yeah, it's the book was entertaining in the sense that it was a beautiful story at the end of the day, as you said, distinguished between the father's hope and the mother's despair. It focused, to my mind, on until you've scared me again, focused in my mind on this beautiful relationship and the father willing to give up anything for his son.
Yeah.
And both as a son who had a father like that and as a father who had aspired to be like that, it was very moving.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mentioned that I had thought about other father and son books. A number came to mind. So one was A River Runs Through It by Norman MacLean. It's one of the few books I've read multiple times. I gave copies of it to my children and to all of my son Ben's friends who had siblings. And they all assumed that it's all about fly fishing, and that's why I liked it. And it is about fly fishing for sure. But more importantly, it's a really beautiful story about the relationship between siblings and between the brothers and their father. And it's really beautiful. Another one, which I read more recently, although I used to read A River Runs Through It every spring. I need to get back to that. Cutting for Stone by Abraham Verghese, a very complicated paternal relationship or relationships in that book. But one of my favorite lines, all sons should write down every word of what their fathers have to say to them. And I think that's just beautiful. And for anybody who's listening, who's a son, do it in real time because it's hard to remember when it counts.
For sure. I wish I had written more.
Yeah.
Written down more of what my father had to say.
Yeah. Yeah. So I find myself writing now, searching my memory, but write things down currently. Kafka by the Shore, Haruki Murakami, which is contrary to the relationship I admired so much in The Road. And then one of my all-time favorites, which captures the same father-son relationship as The Road, and this is the one I recommend to everyone, Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell. So Shakespeare is tortured by the death of his 11-year-old son. He's in tremendous despair. And I don't know if I'm spoiling anything by reciting a line from near the end of this phenomenal novel, but I can never read this line without becoming emotional. And here it goes. He has done what any father would wish to do, to exchange his child's suffering for his own, to take his place, to offer himself up in his child's stead so that the boy might live. Could be right from the road.
Yeah.
And there are lots of other books. I mentioned to Ben that I was doing this, and he mentioned The Great Santini.
Which, I remember that.
A father-son relationship that is so foreign to me, but a great book. Death of a Salesman.
Yeah.
These are tough books. You know, these are tough relationships. And I don't know he got game, but Ben recommended that one as well. So what other Cormac McCarthy have you read and love?
You know, I read All the Pretty Horses a long time ago, and I was going to bone up on it for our podcast, but been under serious deadline pressure lately. You know, No Country for Old Men is, I think, you know, one of my most favorite books, one of my most favorite movies. You know, Cormac McCarthy sure does violence well.
God, does he ever.
I mean, he is.
I wonder about Cormac McCarthy and Stephen King, both just brilliant writers.
Yeah.
Brilliant storytellers, just a wonderful thing. But the violence and the horror associated with what they do.
My God.
Yeah.
I mean, the road is dark for the reasons we discussed, but No Country for Old Men is darker in a very different way.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, wow. Crazy. One of the things I liked about No Country for Old Men, and this has been a fascination of mine, is there are these parallel worlds to ours that go on simultaneously to our world. And that is, one of them is like the military industrial complex, right? You know, you could be driving down the road and there could be a semi trailer with, you know, nuclear waste in it, and you wouldn't know.
Right.
And you drive, you know, like out west in Wyoming and Montana, you would see these, you know, these installations at a distance. And those were missile silos. They're the outbuildings above the missile silos. And in No Country for Old Men, there's this, you know, the drug trade, you know, around the border and all the malevolence and all this stuff that goes on and the violence, even though it was fiction, there was nothing fictional about that level of violence.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, in fact, it's much worse.
Well, it's interesting. So that's what I'll call localized violence as opposed to what we're talking about in the road, which has an impact directly, more broadly.
Yeah.
Both are frightening.
Deeply frightening. And I don't think there's a scarier character in fiction than Anton Chigurh, the guy.
Portrayed by Javier Bardem.
Perfect.
Yeah. God, just looking at the picture, it's frightening.
You know.
So that was great. That was great. That was a great discussion. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me, Howard. It's a real honor.
Well, thank you. I'm going to leave with your expression of hope that you attribute, and I do, to the father in the book.
Yes.
And let's all not only maintain hope, but view the road as a warning.
Yeah.
Who knows if there's anything that can be done, but if there is, we should do it.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Jack.
More information about our guest today can be found on my website, www.bookwormsinthewild.com, which also includes links to the books and other resources we referred to in our discussion. Thanks especially to my podcast team. Dave created the podcast with me and is my producer. Ron is responsible for art direction and design for the podcast, our website, and my bookmark. Melanie, who has designed additional swag, provided overall creative direction. Ben and Eden and Catherine provide additional inspiration and support. And, of course, Carol is my muse. 4-year-old Jake remains a delight beyond words and continues to encourage the podcast, as does Jake's sweet, energetic, wisecracking, and equally delightful two-year-old cousin, Francesca, who always likes to tell me what she's reading. Sweet little baby Mila joined the podcast production intern class 3 months ago, and the three grand loves are hoping for additional help before year end. Thanks to the great Spotify team for making it free and easy to create the podcast. Thanks as well to AJ Falari, who's working on the editing with me. If you liked our podcast, please subscribe. And in any event, let me have your comments either directly on the podcast or at bookwormsinthewild@gmail.com. Looking forward to seeing you on the podcast next time.